and even in Holland and Britain the monarchy was recovering power during the 18th century. In Poland, conditions were peculiar, and they'll be dealt with in a later section. In France, there had been no Magna Carta, and there wasn't quite so definite and effective a tradition of parliamentary rule. There was the same opposition of interests between the crown on the one hand and the landlords and merchants on the other, but the latter had no recognized gathering place and no dignified method of unity. They formed oppositions to the crown, they made leagues of resistance, such was the Fronde, which was struggling against the young King Louis XIV and his great minister Mazarin, while Charles I was fighting for his life in England, but ultimately in 1652, after a civil war, they were conclusively defeated. And while in England, after the establishment of the Hanoverians, the House of Lords and their subservient commons ruled the country, in France, on the contrary, after 1652, the court entirely dominated the aristocracy. Cardinal Mazarin was himself building upon a foundation that Cardinal Richelieu, the contemporary of King James I of England, had prepared for him. After the time of Mazarin, we hear of no great French nobles unless they are at court as court servants and officials. They've been tamed, but at a price, the price of throwing the burden of taxation upon the voiceless mass of the common people. From many taxes, both the clergy and the nobility, everyone indeed who bore a title, were exempt. In the end, this injustice became intolerable, but for a while the French monarchy flourished like the psalmist's green bay tree. By the opening of the 18th century, English writers are already calling attention to the misery of the French lower classes and the comparative prosperity at that time of the English poor. On such terms of unrighteousness, what we may call a grand monarchy established itself in France. Louis XIV, styled the Grand Monarque, reigned for the unparalleled length of 72 years, 1643 to 1715, and set a pattern for all the kings of Europe. At first he was guided by his Machiavellian minister, Cardinal Mazarin. After the death of the cardinal, he himself, in his own proper person, became the ideal prince. He was, within his limitations, an exceptionally capable king. His ambition was stronger than his baser passions, and he guided his country towards bankruptcy through the complication of a spirited foreign policy, with an elaborate dignity that still extorts our admiration. His immediate desire was to consolidate and extend France to the Rhine and Pyrenees, and to absorb the Spanish Netherlands. His remoter view saw the French kings as the possible successors of Charlemagne in a recast Holy Roman Empire. He made bribery a state method, almost more important than warfare. Charles II of England was in his pay, and so were most of the Polish nobility, presently to be described. His money, or rather the money of the tax-paying classes in France, went everywhere. But his prevailing occupation was splendour. His great palace at Versailles, with its salon, its corridors, its mirrors, its terraces and fountains and parks and prospects, was the envy and admiration of the world. He provoked a universal imitation. Every king and princelet in Europe was building his own Versailles, as much beyond his means as his subjects and credits would permit. Everywhere, the nobility rebuilt or extended their chateau to the new pattern. A great industry of beautiful and elaborate fabrics and furnishings developed. The luxurious arts flourished everywhere. Sculpture in alabaster, faience, gilt woodwork, metalwork, stamped leather, much music, magnificent painting, beautiful printing and bindings, fine cookery, fine vintages. Amidst the mirrors and fine furniture went a strange race of gentlemen in vast powdered wigs, silks, and laces, poised upon high red heels, supported by amazing canes, and still more wonderful ladies, under towers of powdered hair, and wearing vast expansions of silk and satin sustained on wire. Through it all postured the great Louis, the sun of his world, unaware of the meagre and sulky and bitter faces that watched him from those lower darknesses to which his sunshine did not penetrate. We can't give here at any length the story of the wars and doings of this monarch. In many ways, Voltaire's Siècle de Louis XIV is still the best and most wholesome account. He created a French navy, fit to face the English and Dutch, a very considerable achievement. But because his intelligence didn't rise above the lure of that Fata Morgana, that crack in the political wits of Europe, the dream of a worldwide Holy Roman Empire, he drifted in his later years to the propitiation of the papacy, which had hitherto been hostile to him. He set himself against those spirits of independence and disunion, the Protestant princes, and he made war against Protestantism in France. Great numbers of his most sober and valuable subjects were driven abroad by his religious persecutions, taking arts and industries with them. The English silk manufacture, for instance, was founded by French Protestants. Under his rule were carried out the dragonnade, a peculiarly malignant and effectual form of persecution. Rough soldiers were quartered in the houses of the Protestants, and were free to disorder the life of their hosts and insult their womenkind as they thought fit. Men yielded to that sort of pressure who would not have yielded to rack and fire. The education of the next generation of Protestants was broken up, and the parents had to give Catholic instruction or none. They gave it, no doubt, with a sneer and an intonation that destroyed all faith in it. While more tolerant countries became mainly sincerely Catholic or sincerely Protestant, the persecuting countries, like France and Spain and Italy, so destroyed honest Protestant teaching that these peoples became mainly Catholic believers or Catholic atheists, ready to break out into blank atheism whenever the opportunity offered. The next reign, that of Louis XV, was the age of that supreme mocker Voltaire, 1694 to 1778, an age in which everybody in French society conformed to the French Church and hardly anyone believed in it. It was part, and an excellent part, of the pose of grand monarchy to patronize literature and the sciences. Louis XIV set up an academy of sciences in rivalry with the English Royal Society of Charles II, and the similar association at Florence. He decorated his court with poets, playwrights, philosophers, and scientific men. If the scientific process got little inspiration from this patronage, it did at any rate acquire resources for experiment and publication and a certain prestige in the eyes of the vulgar. Louis XV was the great-grandson of Louis XIV, and an incompetent imitator of his predecessor's magnificence. He posed as a king, but his ruling passion was that common obsession of our kind, the pursuit of women, tempered by a superstitious fear of hell. How such women as the Duchesse de Châteauroux, Madame de Pompadour, and Madame du Barry dominated the pleasures of the king, and how wars and alliances were made, provinces devastated, thousands of people killed, because of the vanities and spites of these creatures, and how all the public life of France and Europe was tainted with intrigue and prostitution and imposture because of them, the reader must learn from the memoirs of the time. The spirited foreign policy went on steadily under Louis XV towards its final smash. In 1774, this Louis, Louis the Well-Beloved, as his flatterers called him, died of smallpox and was succeeded by his grandson, Louis XVI, 1774-1793, a dull, well-meaning man, an excellent shot, and an amateur locksmith of some ingenuity. Of how he came to follow Charles I to the scaffold, we shall tell in a later section. Our present concern is with grand monarchy in the days of its glory. Among the chief practitioners of grand monarchy outside France, we may note first the Prussian kings, Frederick William I, 1713 to 1740, and his son and successor Frederick II, Frederick the Great, 1740 to 1786.